Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and we always try to do something a little special on Fridays. So we know the Friday commute is tough on lots of people, and we're glad you're here and you spend the time with us. So second hour, we'll do Ask the Priest with Father Scalia. You probably know Father Scalia, wonderful priest who he'll take any question you've got for a priest. You know, maybe it's a pastoral question, something about marriage or family or prayer, or maybe it's a theological question. He can take it also. We'll do that in the second hour. First hour, what's pretty much the most basic question that a human being can face? Well, who am I and who made me? And that involves the possibility that, shock of shocks, there might be a God. And so we have to explore that possibility. One of the people who does a great deal of good in helping other people explore the possibility of the existence of God is Pat Flynn. Pat Flynn is an associate apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Philosophy for the People on the internet, which you should check out. Pat Flynn, thanks for being here with us.
Oh, Cy, I feel like we've been having so many fun conversations lately. I'm looking forward to this one.
Good. Me too. I really look forward to the conversations with you. I love the basic philosophical questions and talking about basic philosophical questions with people who are competent, because it does seem in some ways the more basic a question is, it's almost as if it takes more thought than a more ephemeral question. And the question of God's existence has been at the center of philosophy for a long time. We would probably wish it would be more at the center of modern philosophy or contemporary philosophy, but it's been at the center of philosophy for a long time. So I want to invite anybody who, and especially, I think what we'll do is if you're an atheist yourself, if you don't believe in God, and you haven't had satisfactory arguments made to you about the existence of God, we'll put you up to the top of the line. And the number's 888-318-7884. But anybody can call 888-318-7884. And we'll talk about the proofs for the existence of God this hour with Pat Flynn, and maybe drill down just at the beginning on one particular proof of the existence of God. But even a philosopher such as yourself, Pat, generally I find that you philosopher types say, yes, the existence of God can be proven, but it's an arduous task. Not everyone has the time or the inclination or the brain space to do it.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So you said a lot of good things before that I want to circle back to, but the project of sort of proving God's philosophy is one that sort of comes out of a much wider philosophical system. And I think it's important to understand when we talk about philosophical proofs for God, we are talking about a very classical way of arguing for God's existence. And this classical way is really sort of thinking about the nature of explanation and asking ourselves, is explanation something that needs to stop somewhere? Is there like an ultimate or fundamental explanation in reality that in some sense can explain itself, why it exists, and then kind of explain everything above it, right? Everything that is not self-explanatory. And what traditional philosophers thought, going back to Plato and Aristotle, is they sort of looked out into the world and they realized there's a lot of stuff out there that doesn't really explain itself.
Yes.
And they started to kind of pick out what some of these things were, right? They said changing things. They seem to have something that accounts for why they're changing that ultimately is beyond just that thing itself. Or they would say composite things, right? Things that have parts. There seems to be a need for an extrinsic unifier to make sense of composite things. Aquinas goes a little bit deeper down into the sort of engine room of being, and he says things with a real distinction between their essence, what they are, and their existence need something to explain how existence got imparted to their essence, right? And then later, you have people like Leibniz who think there's contingent things, which is like composite things, especially the way Aquinas thinks about it. They're things that exist, but they don't have to exist, right? So there needs to be some type of explanatory principle that ranges over all contingent things, right? Why are there any contingent things at all, especially since they don't have to exist instead of nothing? And then what all these approaches have in common, Cy, is they essentially say this: either explanation must terminate in something that is like really radically different than any of those types of things, or reality is absurd, right? those are your two options, right? So either there has to be some type of fundamental explanation that can stop this sort of it would be a sort of vicious regress in this respect of why there's composite things or things that are contingent. And it would have to not be one of those things, right? It would have to be a non-contingent thing, which is to say a necessary thing. Yes. Or something whose essence just is its existence, or something that isn't composed. It's absolutely simple. And so the reason I'm impressing this is they weren't trying to just argue for God. They didn't wake up one day and say, you know what, I'm gonna prove my religion today, or something like this, right? They were just trying to figure out the world, and they were just trying, and they were thinking deeply about the nature of explanation, why explanation has to terminate if reality is to actually be intelligible, which it sure seems to be, and what sort of thing could stop explanation in a principled way. And then when they gather enough intellectual steam to arrive at what they think could be a fundamental explanation, and then they contemplate really deeply on that, like what a necessary being is, or what a being whose essence just is its existence is, or what an absolutely simple being is, it turns out that that thing sounds a lot like God, right? It tends to have these divine attributes.
Right. Yeah.
But that's a lot of work, right? That's a lot of thinking. That was a super superficial sketch, but I think it's important to situate how they're going about these proofs of God, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's so much thinking that that really you would need time to master even that manner of thinking. You would need, and I imagine that's probably why people went to sit at the feet of Aristotle, you know, in the days of the Academy, was because you would develop a mode of thinking where you could begin to think through these things all the way without, you know, having the friction of, I just don't even know how to think about that. So I suppose even just the idea that you would have to master a way of thinking means you're going to have some kind of leisure time. you can't just be a guy, a hunter-gatherer out there and prove God's existence unless you're a super genius. And I'm sure there were super genius hunter-gatherers. We're very insulting to cavemen and cavewomen to pretend like they were dumb or something. Now, I'm sure there were super geniuses among them, but then, you know, okay, but that super genius got eaten by a saber-toothed tiger when he was 14. Well, that didn't go very far. So you need a little cultural development and leisure time in order to really develop this thinking.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think you have to have a bit of OCD or something as well to help.
I never thought about that, but that is what some philosophy reads like. Oh my gosh, this guy thought of every single detail.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, maybe a bit of neuroses helps motivate the project a little bit as well. But hey, a lot of good has come out of that. And so, yeah, so that's a traditional way of thinking about it. And I think at the end of the day, Sai, from that project, you do come down to a fundamental choice that you can make. Either explanation has to terminate in something that seems very much like God in classical theism, right? As something that can kind of be the fundamental self-explained explainer, if you want to call it that. Or you just have to assume that reality is absurd because explanations either just extend infinitely, which really just ultimately defers ever giving an explanation for why anything exists instead of not, or it just sort of arbitrarily stops, right? You'll hit something that philosophers often call a brute fact, right? Maybe you're kind of chasing down the sort of very origins of being, and at the bottom of reality, it's just a Disney princess, Sai. That would seem surprising, right? Because like a Disney princess seems like something that requires a cause, right? It's got limits. It doesn't seem like it's a necessary existent, but that's it. Maybe reality is just absurd that way. And everything sort of bottoms out in a Disney princess snapping her fingers. But then we have to say, okay, if that isn't really a satisfactory fundamental explanation, and it's sort of absurd in and of itself, but this is the bottom, right, as far as explanations goes, then has it really explained everything above it? Right? You see, like, as soon as, like, you land in absurdity, it seems like everything becomes absurd, right? All the explanations we thought we had, scientific or philosophical, if they just end in this arbitrary Disney princess snapping her finger, right? Or an electron, if you want to call it that, or whatever, right?
Yeah.
It just seems like we don't actually have any explanations at all. Like all of the explanations were just a fake IOU that bottomed out in absurdity, and then everything is sort of absurd. So that's how I think about it. I think you could, if you're a nicely trained skeptic, you could bite the bullet on the absurd situations. I don't think you can live that way, but that's me kind of hedging the word proof, right? What do we mean by proof? Is it something that forces somebody to believe the conclusion? I don't think we have that sort of thing in philosophy. I think the most we can do is say, here's the cost you're going to have to accept in trying to hop out of this argument. And then you have to decide if you want to live with those costs.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Yes. The proofs for the existence of God. If you're an atheist, you go to the front of the line today. But anybody can call with questions about how we think about these things, how a Catholic, certainly, I mean, Pat and I are both Catholics, how a Catholic thinks about the proofs for the existence of God, what will work, what won't work. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. We have to take our break, our first break, Pat. But when we come back, I want to... unpack the a little bit more what you're saying about that there has to be an ultimate explainer, because I think it's hard to see that, and maybe we need to get a little more detail about how things, all things that we see, all the in the physical world, certainly they have an explanation that is outside of themselves, and then and you can't ever fully understand a rabbit without understanding many, many, many other things, and then you understand those things, and then you go on. And there, so I want to get just sketch that out a little bit more when we come back about why there has to be an ultimate explainer, or everything is absurd. And then we'll go to calls, because folks are starting to call in. There are lines open, however, 888-318-7884.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio with Matthew Bunsen. Join us every week as we talk with the Register's expert writers and editors about the news you need to know and offer authentic Catholic insights on the important stories that impact your life. Register Radio, every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
Hey, the big sale's still going on over at shop.catholic.com. Everything's on sale, 10 to 25% off. In some cases, more than 25% off. Shop.catholic.com. Check out the free shipping. Check out the flat rate shipping on some stuff. Check out the savings on the School of Apologetics courses. Shop.catholic.com. I think it goes on till Easter. Pretty sure that the sale goes on until Easter. Our guest is Pat Flynn. Pat Flynn is an associate apologist here at Catholic Answers, which is a new position and one that has just been of such great benefit to us. And we're just delighted that to be associated with Pat. That makes us look awful good to be associated with people like Pat Flynn. And not that there's a lot of people like Pat Flynn, but it certainly makes us look good. And you can call and talk to Pat about the existence of God if you'd like, 888-318-7884. So you talked about the need for an ultimate explainer, or the cost of rejecting an ultimate explainer is ultimately that the universe is absurd. It's not actually intelligible. You can't actually answer all the questions that need to be that one would want to answer. Could you say a little bit more about that? Because I think it's a and then we'll talk about contingency a little bit. But the and then we'll go to calls. But the idea that in order for there to be an intelligible, a fully intelligible universe, you need to have something that is a necessary being. Yes. Well, explain that to me a little more.
Yeah, for the universe to be fully intelligible, we would say there has to be something that can provide the complete set of answers to the complete set of questions that can be coherently asked. That's what it means to have a fully intelligible universe. And in philosophical circles, most people would think that that means that something like the principle of sufficient reason is true. And the principle of sufficient reason says that, yeah, for anything that exists, and exists in a certain way, there is an adequate explanation for why it exists and why it exists in that way, right? And this ties into the contingency argument as follows, because we're really asking about the existence of things, which is really pretty much the most fundamental question we can ask about anything. And we encounter existence, and we see that many things are contingent. And by contingent, we mean that something exists, but it doesn't have to exist. So to make it intelligible, right, it seems like it's pointing out beyond itself to some extrinsic factors or conditions or causes that have positively contributed to its being. So in a general understanding, a contingent being is something that sort of always derives its existence from something else. It has existence in a sort of derivative way, right? So it's not self-explanatory, at least not completely self-explanatory, especially concerning its existence. And then it becomes a perfectly intelligible, very natural question to ask, well, why are there any contingent things at all? If they don't explain their own existence, it seems like something else has to explain their existence. And we can think about any one contingent thing, or we can just think about all contingent things, however many they are, whether it's a finite number, an infinite number. We can just gather all those contingent facts up and ask not just why are there any contingent facts at all, but why are there these contingent things, specifically these ones in this arrangement? That is another perfectly intelligible question. And this is kind of linking back to Leibniz's famous argument. He's kind of the grandfather of the contingency argument, although I think you see strong family resemblances of this type of argument in thinkers like Aquinas, right? And then we're at sort of a fundamental point of inquiry here, where we say, okay, well, if we're trying to explain the fact that there are any contingent things at all, we can't invoke any further contingency, right? Because that would be viciously circular. But this is something that crucially demands an explanation, right? Otherwise, reality would be absurd. This is something that really needs an explanation. We all feel this, right? And part of what proves that is just the fact that philosophers have asked it forever. They asked it then, they ask it still now, right? So if something's not contingent then, it would be a necessary being, right? Something that exists not, it doesn't have existence derivatively, but has existence in a sort of built-in sort of way. It has necessary existence. It exists in the strongest possible sense, in that it cannot not exist. Yeah. Right. And so we need at least one necessary being. Maybe there's more at first. This argument often proceeds in steps. But the argument would say if there were only contingent beings, then there would actually be like no sufficient condition for anything to exist at all. Because remember, contingent beings don't sort of carry the reason for their existence intrinsically to themselves. So the idea here behind the argument is if there were only contingent beings, no matter how many, no matter how they're arranged, then there wouldn't be a sufficient condition for their existence. They just actually wouldn't exist, in which case there would be nothing. But there is something. So there is a sufficient condition for being. So that would force us to conclude that there has to be at least one necessary being. And that's that category shift we were talking about, right? To make sense of anything in this category, contingency, we need something in an entirely different category, which would be the category of necessity. And then we can think more deeply about what a necessary being is. We haven't said much about that yet. Is it a potato? Is it God? Is it a leprechaun? Who knows yet? That's sort of the next stage of inquiry. But this is how philosophers have typically gone about it. So it's about finding intelligibility and answering questions. And contingency can only seem to be adequately explained in some sense by there being at least one necessary being.
Angus in Nebraska is going to start us off. A bunch of folks on the line. There are two lines open if you want to call and ask your question about proofs for the existence of God. Adam in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Angus in Nebraska. Go ahead, Angus, with your question or comment for Pat Flynn.
Hey, Pat. Si, you're doing a fantastic job.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, good sir. Appreciate it.
My question is, even if you prove that there's a God, How do you tie that back to the Jewish God in the Old Testament?
Yeah, great question.
How do you make that the Jewish God that was written about?
Right.
So Angus, I can answer this from a personal perspective. One thing I did not share in this conversation is I myself was an atheist for many years. So I'm somebody who, I guess I'm your classic story where, you know, a little bit of philosophy kind of brought me very far away from God. And then as I continued in my philosophical journey, I came back around. So Angus, I came to your question where considerations like the ones that we're talking about in this program got me to belief in God, but not religion. So there seemed to be this gap here. I seem to believe in God or the God of the philosophers, but how do I move from the God of the philosophers to the God of the Bible? And is there any reason to want to move that way? So I would say a couple things here that were convincing to me. And some of them are a little, they're deeper and more philosophical, but this was what really motivated me, and maybe you'll find it a little bit helpful, Angus. When it comes to moving from the God of the philosopher to the God of religion, I think you can take a philosophical approach, you can take a historical apologetic approach for the resurrection. I use both. So philosophically, I would say this. I think if you think deeply about God's existence and God's nature, we can really know certain things about God, as many philosophers have said. Not just that God is a necessary being, but God's essence just is pure existence itself. But also in the philosophical tradition, we have other sort of commitments. This is why it's all a system that we talked about before, Sai, right? There's a lot going on here. So I'll just have to give a kind of sketch of some of these commitments. But one of the commitments in the tradition in perennial philosophy is this idea that goodness and being are actually sort of convertible, in a sense, that when we think about the nature of goodness, what goodness is it's sort of being that is actualized in a way that it perfects its nature. So take my bad eyesight, for example. I have glasses on right now. We say it's kind of bad for me to be blind. I'm not completely blind, but I've got very poor eyesight. But when we think about blindness, it's not something we can grab. It's not something we can touch. It's actually something that's missing. It's a do-good gone missing. It's something, it's sort of a wound or a fissure in the order of being. There's being that should be there, but isn't there. This is a very traditional commitment, right? Now, if it's true, that being and goodness are, in a sense, convertible, and God's essence just is pure being itself, well, then it's going to follow that God's essence is just pure goodness itself. So this is actually how you can start to work out God's goodness. Now, God's goodness is going to be very different than our goodness because God doesn't have a nature like we do. But we can still get enough to say that God is perfectly good. Now, how does this at all tie to the God of the Bible? Well, let me tell you how it eventually motivated me. It was this. If God is supreme, if he's all good, if he's all loving, and I think you can know these things philosophically, and something has gone really wrong in this world, which I think you can know just by opening your eyes or reading the newspaper. Like, there's really been a falling away from God in some sense, that there's something like a fall. Like, humanity has taken a wrong turn somewhere. Well, if God really is supremely good, it just seems like God would try to draw us back to himself, right? If something went wrong, it seems like a perfectly good God would not just try to draw us back to himself, but I think part of being loving is also seeking union with your beloved, right? And when I think about these qualities, there's a religion that stands out rather starkly, or did for me, and that's Christianity, because Christianity teaches something, some core doctrines of Christianity are the incarnation and the atonement, that God literally assumed a human nature, a phenomenal mystery, which is an incredibly intimate union with human nature in general. Why? To bring all of us back into union with himself. So the way I thought about this, or the way I came to think about it, and I guess it's a little quirky, is that I think a certain conception of God, the right philosophical conception of God, actually makes a prediction in a scientific sense where we could expect something like Christianity, right? If God exists and he's all loving, and something really did go wrong in the world, it makes sense that God would try to draw us back to himself. And when I look at the sort of plausible religious stories that have any sort of historical credibility whatsoever, and I think Christianity has a lot of historical credibility, that is the type of story I would expect given the philosophy of God that I hold. And it's that made Christianity really rationally plausible to me. It sort of just fit very naturally. And of course, I think that God revealing himself to us is not something that would be surprising either. But it's that the good seeking union and return made Christianity extremely attractive to me. And then I just looked into the historical details, and I found what I thought was an adequate basis there that I continued my investigation and eventually became Catholic. So sorry, that's a very long-winded response, but hopefully it will show you some ways that you can begin to bridge that gap, if it makes sense.
Angus, what do you think?
It was a nice testimony, but he failed to prove anything. He started out at the beginning talking about good and evil and to me, good and evil is how it relates to human beings. There's no actual entity that's good and evil. It's all like, how does that relate to mankind?
Yeah, real quick, Angus, you said, you know, I didn't prove anything. Again, the word proof here, I think, is going to be a little bit misleading. I said from a particular philosophy of God, you can have a rational expectation or prediction. So this is a sort of very scientific way of thinking, right? We might have a hypothesis and we can ask, what would we expect to come from that hypothesis? And I'm saying good philosophy of God can lead you to expect something like Christianity. And in that sense, that you find Christianity, this is sort of confirmatory evidence and it becomes very rational to accept it. Is it a proof? No. But is it a rational motivation? Yes.
Right back with more, Angus. Thank you very, very much.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Does the Church have too many rules? Join me, Dr. David Anders, as we answer your questions right here on Called to Communion, Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Always try to do is mix it up a little bit on Fridays and have a good entertaining show, especially for those because I have a lot of, having done it myself for so long and still about to do it at the end of this show, that Friday commute, man, you need something good. And so one of the good things we got is Pat Flynn here with us to talk about proofs for the existence of God. A lot more calls, Pat. Shall we just go back to the phones?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's go to Alan in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Listening on EWTN Radio. Alan, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Pat. Alan? Oh, hang on, Alan. Oh, I did it again. I pushed the wrong button. Alan, go ahead. I'm so sorry, Alan.
Okay.
That's okay.
That's okay. There's a lot of electronics involved.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent, excellent program. Loving it. I grew up an atheist, God came to me when I was about 21, and he, like you were saying, God's wanting to draw mankind to himself. I felt this drawing, and I could only explain it through the Holy Spirit, a drawing to him. But my mind was still an atheist because I grew up thinking that science knew everything and that science had proven that there was no God. And so my mind had to catch up with what this experience I had with God. And so what you're talking about was the kind of things that I've just devoured through my whole life.
Wonderful, Alan.
The existence of God, the proof of God, because your mind has to kind of catch up with where your heart is. So,
Pat, I'd like to get your
loving this.
Hang on, Alan, we'll come right back. I just want to get Pat's comment on what you just said.
Yeah, God bless you, Alan. That's a beautiful story. And I would be curious, was there any particular argument or consideration of evidence that helped you get the head aligned with the heart on the matter? I just would like to hear more about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when I became a Christian, my heart was drawn to God. God made himself real to me in a supernatural way. So I just started getting books, just started reading. But this was back in the 60s, and there wasn't as much evidence, scientific evidence, as there is today. So all through my life, I have been studying science. You know, when the Big Bang became popular, I was like, oh my gosh, there is a beginning point. There is a creation. You know, and I went to work and I told all my colleagues, I said, man, they discovered that the universe had a beginning. And nobody thought it was very impressive except me. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, they're beginning to prove the existence of God, like you say, or close to proving the existence of God. And then just, you know, with dark matter and dark energy and the forces of the universe, and then the fine tuning of the universe.
So it's kind of the science of the cosmos was confirmatory for you, Alan.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. One of the biggest one is just the, how intricate everything is, and everything has to have the right number for us to be here. The fine tuning of the universe. Fascinating. And every new discovery has a number that has to be exact for us to be here. And I mean, this is fascinating.
And so, Alan, so you're not citing proofs. You didn't need proofs. You needed evidence that was intellectually compelling evidence, and you got it.
Yes, because I had to have enough evidence to catch up with where my heart was going. My heart was going toward Jesus.
Oh,
like
praise
a freight
God.
Train. But if my mind, if I couldn't intellectually confirm it, then I was going to have a battle my whole life.
Pat.
Because I'd always say, yeah, this experience you had with God, but it doesn't make intellectual sense.
No, you still got to do a lot of work on that. Pat, I wonder if you have any comment for Alan.
Yeah, I have three comments. I think there's a lot of really good stuff here. One is a comment on science for scientism. Another comment is on what should your default position be? Should you be default an atheist or default theist? And Cy, this links back to our conversation on agnosticism. And three is, what counts as evidence in these type of worldview debates or considerations? Those are the three things I drew out of Alan's comment here. So the first one is you thought that science had proved everything or disproved God. And whenever I hear that, even when I was an atheist, I never thought that. I always saw science as a very powerful enterprise. I still do. But it's limited. You know, even physics, technically it's sort of etiological. Science tells us how one physical process sort of leads to or unfolds to another physical process. But it's not ontological or metaphysical, which is what we're doing a lot in this conversation, which would ask, why are there any physical events or physical things or physical processes at all? And that's just completely out of the realm of science, right? Science can't tell us anything about those deeper ontological questions, and those seem like perfectly coherent and, in fact, the most important questions that you can ask. So, I would just want to distinguish for the gentle listener between scientism, which is a sort of philosophical posture that says the only things we can know are things which sort of come through the hypothetical-deductive method, the scientific method. Now, notoriously, that claim doesn't even meet its own standard because it's making a claim that we could never know scientifically, right? It's just a pure, philosophical stance. So it's got this sort of internal inconsistency issue. So I think you can set that aside, and then you can ask, going to the third point, what would count as sort of scientific evidence for the existence of God? And when we ask, well, what counts as evidence? Sometimes people say there's no evidence for God or for that. We have to ask, well, what do we mean by evidence? And when I think of evidence, Cy, I think, well, first we have to think about what is our hypothesis, right? And what would we expect to see given how our hypothesis, and then do we see what we would expect? If so, then it counts as evidence, that in some sense supports or confirms our hypothesis. So let me explain this with a simple example, right? If I step outside and I see my driveway is wet, I immediately form a hypothesis. I think, oh, it rained, right? But then say I kind of look around and I see that just my driveway is wet, but nothing else is. Well, then I sort of immediately revise my hypothesis to say, well, maybe my sprinkler turned on, right? Because if it rained, I would expect that everything would be wet, not just my driveway. So in that sense, you know, what I expect to see, just my driveway being wet, counts as evidence for one hypothesis, my sprinkler turning on, over the other hypothesis, it raining, right? Because the raining hypothesis sort of overpredicts in a sense. However, if I then turn around my car and I see that there's a bucket of suds and an unraveled garden hose and even a love note from my wife, then I might revise my hypothesis again to think that my wife washed my car and the sprinkler didn't turn on, right? So, and I would say that counts as evidence, right? Evidence, but evidence for what? A particular hypothesis, right? So then to ask what could count as evidence for God requires us to get clear on what God is and what are the sorts of things that we would expect to see if God exists versus what would we expect to see if God does not exist. Now, you pointed to two things. One is that, I guess the general sort of mainstream consensus in Big Bang cosmology is that the universe began to exist some 13.8 billion years ago. And the fine-tuning of the universe, that it seems like our universe is just set up so exquisitely right from the beginning that if things were off just by a hair's breadth, there would just be no possibility for interactive intelligent life at all, right? And the numbers on this are just unbelievably precise, right? And then you can just ask, would I expect these things more if God existed? Or would I expect these things more if God did not exist and naturalism is true? And I like framing it this way, Sai, because you don't have to make it a proof, right? Yeah. You can just ask, what is my broad degree of expectation? I think it's enormously obvious, right? If I would so much more expect the universe to be so exquisitely fine-tuned, to have the marks of some super calculating super intellect, if there actually is a super calculating super intellect, then if there isn't, right? And, you know, even if there are some models that might still be plausible to show that the universe is eternal, I don't find those models finding as much traction among my physicist friends. But again, would I expect that the universe had a beginning if God didn't exist? Actually, no. My natural expectation would just be that the universe was just sort of past eternal, right? The fact that it seems like science is converging upon the universe having a beginning is something that I would better expect on the theistic hypothesis rather than not. And in that sense, it counts as evidence for or is confirmatory of that hypothesis. And then we can argue about how much evidence that is. Maybe you feel it's great force. Maybe you think it's moderate force. Maybe you think it's just like a little weight in the scale. But nevertheless, I think that's the better way to look at it, because sometimes people just, yeah, they're just like, you have to prove it to me. You have to prove it. But I mean, look, man, none of us go around just offering deductive proofs for most of the things we believe, even the most really important things we believe. Is it reasonable to believe? Is there good evidence to believe it? Is there rational motivation? And in that sense, what Alan said really, really struck me I think there is, even scientifically, when we think about it in the right way.
Mm-hmm. That brings us right to the break. So I want to say thank you, Alan. A beautiful story, and one that is more common, I think, than we often like to talk about, that people feel that personal pull, I think is how Alan described it, pull towards God, towards Jesus, towards the church, and that can start people on a wonderful, wonderful journey, or we can choose to not follow it. But it happens a lot more than we like to talk about, I think, or that we do take the time to talk about. So thanks, Alan. We'll take our break, right back with more on God's existence with philosopher Pat Flynn right after this.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Easter. EWTN Radio posts 11 podcasts every weekday and over 60 per week. They're the perfect companion for the busy Catholics everywhere. With on-demand access to audio, you can pause and pick up right where you left off anytime, anywhere, and they're all free. Subscribe by going to EWTNradio.net, then click on podcasts. They're waiting for you. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our time growing short with Pat Flynn, so we'll get to as many calls as we can. Second hour, we're going to have Father Paul Scalia here with us, a wonderful priest from the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia, and we'll do Ask a Priest with Father, also a wonderful writer with some very fine books. So you'll enjoy talking with him, and you can ask him anything that you would ask a priest. In anything that you'd think, I wish I had a priest around to ask that question, you can ask Father Scalia the next hour. Now we go to Felipe right here in San Diego, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Felipe, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Pat Flynn.
Hi, Cy. Hi, Pat. Thank you both for taking my call. Wow, lots to unpack here. You know, if I could, you, before I ask my question, right, Pat, you mentioned the word no. Right. And myself and the listeners are wanting to know how we prove the existence of God and in some cases wanting to know God himself. Right. And from, you know, from my perspective, to know God requires the same things that it requires in the secular world. So you're out there in the secular world and you want to know how to shoot the free throw correctly. So what you do is you go out and you practice. And if you want to know about, you know, the animal kingdom, you put in the time and you put in the effort and you get to know about the animal kingdom. So for all the listeners out there that want to know, I would simply say put in the effort, right? Because putting in the effort, like we do with everything else, like we do, in fact, with our relationships with our loved ones and even our relationships with the people that we don't love, right? We put in the time. We speak to them. We spend time with them. And that way we get to know them. So from my perspective, putting in that time of prayer, making that step, actually, right? The beginning is to make that step, to turn towards God and to make the effort to get to know him. Then he begins to reveal himself to you little by little until the proof isn't necessary, right? The proof isn't required because you know him, because you have a relationship with him, and because because he has chosen to reveal himself to you in whatever way, through your family, in the church, through the sacraments, in nature, through your friends. You know, anyway, so my question is this, and I'm sorry to kind of ramble on that way, but my question is, do we know, does the church know historically in the secular record, I suppose is what I'm asking, the actual dates that the first Triduum took place? So Holy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and Easter Sunday. And can that be a measure of some proof for the existence first of Christ and then, of course, God, because we believe that Christ is God?
Pat?
Yeah, great question. I don't know the answer to the first part of that, if we know the exact dates or not. That's just not something that I've encountered.
Only Jimmy Akin does.
But I was going to bring up Jimmy Akin because that ties into a general historical apologetic for both the reliability of the Gospels or the reliability of the historical record sort of surrounding the core facts of Christianity. And that leads then into what is the best explanation for those facts. And I bring up Jimmy Akin because he just had, a marvelous debate against one of the world's most renowned skeptics on the issue. And I thought that Jimmy just did an incredible job defending the historical reliability of the Gospels, which of course include certain facts that call out for an explanation. Facts like not just the existence of Jesus, and that is something that most skeptics of Christianity and religion, and most atheists, they don't really deny the existence of Jesus. In fact, Bart Ehrman, Jimmy's debate partner, has an entire book sort of refuting Jesus mythicism. So even though he isn't himself a Christian, from a historical perspective, he very much defends the historical reality of the person of Christ. So yeah, that's one aspect. His crucifixion is another one. Then you have, of course, the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances. And I think the way I think about this is you do have a very good sort of adequate historical basis for this, where you can then sort of make an inference to the best explanation, what's going to make the best sense of all of these facts. And then if you already sort of believe in God and you consider some of the things I talked about earlier in this program, then I think there's just a very natural explanation, which is the traditional one, that God really did kind of give his divine endorsement, raising Jesus bodily from the dead. And in fact, we would expect a miracle in this sort of situation. It seems like whatever else miracles may do, being a sort of sign of divine endorsement is certainly one of them. So we should expect miracles to be rare and have a lot of sort of moral and religious significance when they occur. And this seems to meet all that criteria. Now, the other question is, so if you already believe in God, I think it fits like hand in glove, right? And that's where I was when I really was working my way into the church. But you could also ask, well, what if you don't believe in God? Is the historical evidence strong enough that it should, for the resurrection, say, is it strong enough that it should actually kind of like move you from atheism to theism? And here I'll just recommend the work of two philosopher friends of mine, Tim and Lydia McGrew. They have a lot of really good work on this, and they want to argue, yes, when you get down to the historical nitty-gritties, the sort of reliability of the core Christian facts, and the inadequacy of any naturalistic explanation to account for them should in fact cause most people who are atheists to become theists. Now, of course, this is always counterbalancing other reasons. Maybe you think you just have so many good reasons to be an atheist, it can't be completely counterbalanced by, say, the historical apologetic. But they make a pretty good case that the historical apologetic is strong enough that it should flip most atheists actually to belief in God from a purely historical standpoint. So I'm not sure if that's answering your question exactly, but that's something that I thought of when reflecting on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Felipe, we do have other callers and I'm going to go to them, but I will tell you this. I mentioned Jimmy Akin, and Jimmy has an article called Seven Clues that tell us precisely when Jesus died. And he gives the date of Friday, April 3rd, AD 33, but you have to read the whole article. And it's in the National Catholic Register. Seven clues tell us precisely when Jesus died in the National Catholic Register, if you want to follow up on actually nailing down the date. Let's go to Scott in Texas, listening on 9:10 a.m. Scott, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for our guest, Pat Flynn.
Hi, Mr. Flynn. Listen, this question comes at a kind of a bad time because my life thing right now is to be trying to be lighthearted. It's anything but lighthearted. Anyhow, here's my question. You really cannot prove the existence of God. You can't do it. Your comments?
That's a question, or is that just?
I think he wants you to comment on his statement that you.
Comment on the statement
that you cannot prove that God exists.
Yeah, so this word proof has come up a lot, and this is why I think it was good that we spent a fair amount of time in the beginning talking about what sort of rational investigation is going on for the existence of God. If we mean by proof that I can give you some series of statements that's going to compel you to believe, like that you just absolutely have to believe when these sentences hit your brain, no, I don't. But I don't think you have that in any area of philosophy or really arguments for anything. If we mean, can we give strong rational motivation where each step in the argument contains sort of premises or commitments that are certainly more plausible than their negation, then yeah, I think that there's lots of rational motivations that make belief in God extremely reasonable. In fact, probably, the more reasonable position to hold than alternative hypotheses. So it all comes down to sort of what you mean by proof. Even more traditionally, the term proof was thought to be a sort of metaphysical demonstration. And the idea of a metaphysical demonstration is this. It's not like a mathematical proof. It works a little bit differently. But the idea is we start from some experience that cannot be coherently denied. Say that things are changing, or that things are contingent, or that things are composite. You know, something that certainly all the sciences have to presuppose in something, right? So they're like conceptually pre-scientific, right? Then from there, what we do is we run a kind of conceptual analysis on what conditions have to be in place for that phenomena to be not just intelligible, but to actually occur. And then the idea there is we can proceed via a series of sort of logical steps, logical deductions to God's existence. So that's getting closer to something like a mathematical proof, but it's still not quite a mathematical proof. So you start from some undeniable aspect of experience, then you string together a series of logical steps that do entail the conclusion of classical theism. And this you would find in thinkers like Aquinas and Suarez and Scotus and many contemporary Thomists today. But again, if people come in to these conversations with the notion of proof like a mathematical proof or something that compels somebody to believe, then no, I don't think that we have that in arguments for the existence of God. But I don't think that's a problem. So,
Scott, thank you. I'm going to try to get everybody on that I can with Pat Flynn before we have to go. Ken, right here in California, watching on YouTube. Try to be a little quick with your question, Ken, to give Pat a chance to answer.
Sure. Pat, can you please give some proofs for the divine attributes in Aquinas' De Ente et Essentia?
Yeah, so Aquinas' De Ente et Essentia on being an essence. I should probably sketch the argument very quickly. So what Aquinas does in that project is he argues for the real distinction between essence and existence. And then he claims that since there are things whose essence is really distinct from its existence, these things always have to have existence imparted to them. So you have to get back to some being whose essence just is its existence as that sort of fundamental explanatory fact. Now, your question was, how do we extract the divine attributes from this? Now, this again is where you need a sort of system in place. Aquinas has a very... he's just got a lot of metaphysics that he's working with. So let me try and sketch some of the paths that Aquinas takes. So first off, if something is essence just is its existence, then it's a necessary being. Like it exists in a very robust way. It doesn't have a cause because it doesn't need existence imparted to it. It's to be just is to be. So it's a necessary being. From here, quickly, we can get to uniqueness, right? If you try to imagine that there are two necessary beings, right, for them not to be the self-same reality, there must be some difference between them, some additional feature, if you will, like atop of their necessary nature that they have in common. But if the difference is contingent, then the being is itself composite and requires a cause of that contingent part, right? So that contradicts its necessary nature. So that isn't going to work. Alternatively, if the differences are necessary to each, and I'll just have to say this quickly and just we'll have to rewind a tape to catch it. But if the differences are necessary to each, then each lacks some essential feature that the other has on account of having a necessary nature. And so it's not actually necessary, right? And then we get another contradiction. So that's how Aquinas can get to uniqueness, that there can only be sort of one being of this sort. It can't be multiplied because it's not susceptible to differentiating features, so it's uniqueness. Then we can get to the other attributes, like goodness, as I sketched earlier, because for Aquinas, essence and existence relate to each other as potency to act in creatures, right? So Phaedo's essence stands as something in potency that could be actualized, it could be exist if existence actualizes it. So existence stands on the actuality side, generally essence stands on the potency side. But if you have something whose essence just is its existence, and you have something that is purely actual, has no potency whatsoever, and then if you have a purely actual being, you're going to be able to get a being that is not only simple but immutable, because immutability requires moving from a potential state to an actual state, but this being has no potential. You also have pure goodness, because for badness requires privations and potential, so anything that's purely actual is going to be purely good. You're going to have omnipotence. Why do you have omnipotence? Because whatever this fundamental necessary being is the ultimate cause of anything else that exists or could exist, and so on and so forth. So we're running out of time, but this is how you begin to unload the divine attributes from his De Ente et Essentia. I hope that's an adequate start.
Ken, thank you for that question. That was fun. It was like speed philosophy there at the end, getting in the various attributes of God. Pat Flynn, you can check out his work at Philosophy for the People. That's your podcast, Philosophy for the People. And he's an associate with us here at Catholic Answers, something we're very pleased with. Pat Flynn, thanks for taking the time for us. I hope you have a very blessed and happy Holy Week.
Oh, thank you. You too, Si. Thank you so much.
Look forward to talking with you again. Coming up next, Father Paul Scalia. It'll be Ask a Priest. So we'll change directions a little bit. You can ask Father Paul anything that you would ask a priest right after this on Catholic Answers Live.